Our next speaker truly needs no introduction, but nonetheless, this is Sarah Patel Pacheco, and she's a partner with the law firm of Jackson Walker LLP, board certified in estate planning law. And not only is she incredibly successful in her own practice, but she's so generous in giving her time, being an author of many practice guides, and always being a wonderful speaker. So thank you, Sarah. She's here today to speak about the settlements of guardianship disputes.
Thank you. Is Paul still here? Now, Paul, you thought you got dinged by being the first speaker. Here's my story about Wes. Last night, he lied to me. Said, 8:30 in the morning, that is so early. He said, no, I thought it was the first. He goes, no, Sarah. He said, we always put the first person, that's the best speaker of the day. I showed up here, I'm like, Paul's speaking. Clearly, he does not think I'm the best speaker of the day. But you did a fabulous job. I would have given you some of my time. It was a wonderful speech. Anyways, unlike Paul, I don't have a rule of evidence or a book I can point you to talk about my topic today. It is about settlement agreements and settlement disputes and guardianship. And all of us know one of our first mantras in guardianship is try not to have a guardianship. And two, if you have a guardianship, try and preserve as many rights you can for the ward or proposed ward. And three, try and get them resolved as quickly as possible. Because typically a lot of money is spent, some of it the wards, and what are we accomplishing at the end of the day? Sometimes it's very positive, sometimes it's just a lot of family emotion that has percolated to this point. So it takes a lot of creativity. So I can't point you to a book or right or wrong way and tell you this is the way you have to do it. What I can do, though, is give you some guidelines as you settle these cases to try and know how to frame them, how to enforce them, and things to think about. And that's my job as the second speaker next to Paul of the morning. So with that, let's get going. So let's talk about the basis for settlements, just a couple of fundamentals to remind everyone. Essentially, in guardianships, we know there's contract law, but there's four essentially bases to frame your settlement. One, we know, is contract law, right? You have to have material terms, you have to have essential terms, which that's whatever the court decides they are going to be at the end of the day. Yeah, that's the when, the how, the parties. And then you may have to make sure if it's a written agreement, meaning if it's within the course of litigation or any other terms that require and meet the statute of frauds, it has to be in writing. Why do I say that? Because before litigation is actually filed, you can have enforceable oral agreements. Now, that may be a little hard to do with somebody that's alleged to be incapacitated. That gets back to Paul's paper and other speakers. But you can, so you have to be careful. If you're having discussions of how to settle something pre-suit, just keep in mind those agreements, oral agreements, can arguably be enforceable. Which is why we have the next basket, Rule 11 agreements. What it says is once the lawsuit is filed, once the petition is filed, the application is filed, anything is filed at the courthouse, from then on, your agreements have to be in writing, fundamentally in writing. That's what Rule 11 requires. It also requires that for it to be enforceable in the proceeding, it has to be filed of record. And there's a dispute whether if you revoke your agreement to the Rule 11 agreement before it's actually filed of record, whether it can still be enforced. But I think once it is filed, it is enforceable as a Rule 11 agreement, and we'll come back to discuss kind of the nuances of the enforcement of those in a minute. And it can be one writing or it can be a series of writings. So this is where caution is always worth, just be careful about this. If you do a letter to some person and you say, well, we'll consider this, or we'll settle on these terms more clearly, they send you back and say, okay, well, I want X, Y, and Z. Okay, we'll do X and Y, but not Z. And finally, somebody says, okay, this is what my client will agree to. That can be an enforceable agreement. Maybe you don't intend it to be an enforceable agreement. Maybe you intended it to be then put into a full and final, well-vetted agreement with all the terms and maybe a release you forgot to put in there. Just be careful. Those agreements have been held by the Supreme Court. Again, if it's the intent of all material terms, they'll read them together and enforce them, even though something you wish you had placed in there or wanted all the bells and whistles was not in there. So careful. And then finally, there's two more. There's the Civil Practice and Remedies Code section on mediations. We know that mediators actually like this to be in term sheets. They think it makes a difference from just Rule 11 agreements, but that just says an agreement reached to mediation is enforceable. And I think the reason a part of that is because we have all these communications and mediation that are privileged. But once you sign the agreement, once you have the term sheet, it is no longer privileged and fully enforceable, including discussions regarding the intent of that agreement, can potentially come in.